Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Marilyn Rivchen. Rivchen received a bachelor's degree in art history from Barnard College. She is a filmmaker, photographer, and videographer. She has taught filmmaking and digital media at Cornell University since 1979 in the Department of Theater, Film, and Dance. Her own media work has encompassed many contrasting areas of interest, including documentary and experimental films and projections for live dance and theater performance. Last spring, she created the amazing video projections for the Cornell production of Bernstein's Mass. And currently, she's working on documentary videos for the Cornell Prison Project. Welcome to the show, Marilyn.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Now, your early interest was in art history. So what led you in that direction early on?
Well, when I started at Barnard, I didn't know what I was going to major in, and it's one of those exploratory things where I began thinking I'd be an English major, moved into psychology and philosophy. But when I took my first art history course, it stuck.
Uh-huh. And you
it really hit home. I was doing both art and music, I would say, as I was growing up.
Uh-huh.
And something about art history just filled a huge need.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Well, history tells us about our culture. So if you were interested in psychology and all those other things, it's a way to encompass it all. Well, were you a practicing artist yourself ever?
You mean before college?
Or during the time when you were interested in art history?
Well, Barnard didn't have a fine arts program itself, but it had a relationship with Columbia University, of course. And I took drawing and painting studio classes at Columbia.
Ah, so you were interested in...
Mm-hmm. Oh,
were you ever interested in pursuing it as a career?
Well, I became interested in filmmaking while I was in college, and that, like you say, it encompasses so many things, as art history does, having a kind of timeline for history that you can structure from any number of disciplines. But I found that film suited some level of visual interest, but also includes so many things. It's a synthetic medium, and you can make a film about anything.
Now, you were at the assistant director at the Johnson Museum Art for a time, and during that time, you decided to take a class in 16mm filmmaking at UCLA. How did you start that? Did you just say, I want to learn how to make films?
Okay, this is, to me, ancient history, but I'll try to go there.
Uh-huh.
I was married at the time, and my former husband was from Los Angeles. And I was doing still photography at the time that I was also working at the Johnson Museum. And for a summer, he suggested that we go to L.A. We were both really interested in film and had started working in really tiny 8mm little cameras on our own, and it was very exciting. So taking a 16mm course at UCLA for summer, intensive summer, was terrific. The specific program was not your usual right after undergraduate MFA kind of program. It was, in fact, intended for professionals in other fields.
Mm-hmm.
So as a museum proto-curator at the time, my interest was in making films about art and about artists. And that was my immediate goal in taking that course.
Uh-huh. And then, so when did you start making creative films and turning that into what now is your career in part?
Well, even then in 8mm, we lived during our senior year at Barnard and Columbia. We lived right near the cloisters. And of course, being an art history major, I was spending a lot of time in museums and galleries and could just cross the street into Fort Tryon Park and walk around the cloisters and shoot film. We did that over the period of a year and edited these tiny little, on tiny little editing splicers and viewers. I would say very beautiful kind of expression for the time.
Mm-hmm. And what were some of the other subjects that you started concentrating on? When did you actually start getting into documentaries?
Well, this could take us into Haiti.
Okay.
And with that very much on our minds right now because of the just recent earthquake and the events and terrible misery that's going on there. When I was finished... or what hit me as being finished with my museum career was to, in fact, become an artist. That is, allow myself to not just think about hanging other people's pictures on the walls and curating shows and writing about art, but also making my own work.
Mm-hmm.
So I had an opportunity to go to Haiti and I did. I lived there for 2 years in the mid-70s and got involved very early on with the creative work of people living in a village in the mountains outside of Port-au-Prince. Mm. And when I saw the work exhibited, I said, well, this is incredible. I can go into more details about that. But basically what happened was I suggested to the museum here that they do a show of work, even though I no longer worked there. I was in contact with people, of course, and suggested what a fantastic show this would be. This is the work of untrained artists in a village called Saint-Soleil. And the museum thought it was interesting, but they couldn't support that. And coincidentally, later the same year, the first year I was in Haiti, the United Nations decided they were going to use film to document for the UN delegates innovative programs going around the world to solve human population problems, human habitat problems. The rubric was habitat. Mm. And that was a habitat conference that happened in 1976. 1975, I made a film with a colleague in Haiti to document this village and this village project, which was called Saint-Soleil Art for a New Life.
So that was one of your first documentaries.
Yeah, and that was shown at the UN conference in Vancouver, Canada, and was distributed among the other 200 or so films made around the world.
Hmm.
And it was fascinating because it really was about development from the inside. And two Haitian artists had started this concept of giving people art materials without any training in a village, in a very poor village of subsistence farming, who then just created incredible work. But beyond that, it empowered them. Mm-hmm. To come together as a village. And so really it was a kind of community building empowerment project in which people in this village not only succeeded as artists, but also came together and improved their infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. And then this must have shown you how powerful it is to be a filmmaker. You can bring certain parts of the world to the rest of the world. And it's a powerful tool as a documentarian.
Well, it certainly was a powerful experience. Living there all together was a powerful experience. Mm-hmm. Being able to be involved in that project was one of those peak experiences of being in the right place at the right time and having the right interests to get involved in it.
And it all came together at once. Now when did you start doing projections and that kind of media work for dance, performance, and theater? That seems like an interesting and very different segue.
Yeah, I guess for people listening who could not see the connection at all. I've always been interested in both abstraction and experimental art, as well as documentary and political issues. So for me, it's a balance of doing either both of those kinds of things over time simultaneously or one after the other to find some kind of balance in the work, in my working process. So on the projection side, it didn't start as projections. It started by working with dancers, dancers and choreographers, people who were friends, people who were colleagues and became friends. At Cornell, I teach in the Department of Theater, Film, and Dance. Mm-hmm. So I've known a lot of theater people, actors, directors, as well as dancers and choreographers. And my own interest in more experimental work really coincides more with the dance faculty and dancers and choreographers that I've known.
Did you propose this, though? I mean, it would be a creative moment to have projections during a dance performance? How did this even transpire, that this kind of medium would be used in a dance performance?
Well, I would attribute that to one particular choreographer friend named Lana Wilkinson, who came to teach at Cornell in the mid-80s. I was already teaching there. And, you know, dancers, what they do when they perform is so transitory. They need documentation. And so I had worked with a lot of friends who were dancers to videotape their work for them and out of my own interest. It's, for me, something very spontaneous and special to film a live dance performance that I've never seen before. Mm-hmm. That's one of the more exciting things. I'm sure people who film sports might feel the same way because you can't exactly predict what's going to happen. It's very different if you film with one or two or multiple cameras, something that's been very rehearsed and very planned. So that's interesting to me, too, because I edit a lot. Mm-hmm. But shooting something spontaneously is really the most interesting thing for me. It's almost like doing Tai Chi while dancing with a camera. So, anyhow, so I had been doing a lot of dance documentation, and Lana came to Cornell and contacted me, and this happens a lot, I'm sure, with people in a lot of fields.
Yeah.
You get calls out of the blue, you get contacted and say, oh, I hear you do this. Would you be interested in working with me? And we ended up having a terrific collaboration for about 5 years that she taught at Cornell. And we developed a number of pieces that she choreographed, and I would create films that would be projected. It actually started with 16-millimeter film.
Mm-hmm.
And a number of pieces that we made, she toured around the country with, and sometimes I would be able to go. And actually, we performed in San Francisco and a number of cities. She was a wonderful performer. She's no longer dancing, but that was a long time ago.
And then when you're creating these things for dance, is there a way that you have to do this so that you aren't upstaging the dancers?
Well, that's a great question, because I'm extremely sensitive to that issue, having worked in this area for a long time now. It's now 20 years or so. It's all about balance. It's all about being complementary. And that's why in doing the projections for Mass, you know, is such a collaborative process. It's not like my making a film and throwing it up on three screens. It's a kind of detailed synthesis of what's going on in terms of stage movement, especially with dance, but even with theater, with the music, with the rhythms, with the lighting design. That's another aspect that has to be very complementary.
Now, I was thinking about Mass, and I was thinking, you're bringing modern world technology into these old pieces. I mean, and that must be hard to collaborate with old work and bring all this new medium in without upstaging, you know, some of the points of the old work.
By old work, you mean?
Well, I mean, like Bernstein's Mass is not from the video era or the digital era.
Correct. Not the digital era, but, you know, it was a bit postmodern for its time.
Mm-hmm. Well, you made it even more so with this production.
Right. But, I mean, when Bernstein, when that was first produced in the early 70s, I'm not saying it's a great piece of music. I know that there's a lot of criticism about it. But at the time, I think it was a little too postmodern before postmodern really happened.
Ah.
People saw it as too much of a pastiche of different genres. That happens to interest me. And it's a part of the challenge, I think, too, so that in the videos you saw things like graffiti, which actually was happening.
Oh, it all worked. It worked.
No, I mean, it was even happening at that time. But, of course, I used a lot of religious imagery that comes from, you know, very early Christian iconography that suited certain aspects of the Mass in a more traditional way.
It was a very interesting production, I must say. If you're just joining us, my guest is Marilyn Rivchen. She's a filmmaker and videographer, and she teaches at Cornell's Department of Theater, Film, and Dance. Now, I want to ask you about this. The word experimental is used often for filmmakers. Well, what does that mean to you?
You know, it reminds me of something I heard Twyla Tharp say in an interview some years ago, where somebody said, oh, you do this really interesting experimental work, and she was very adamant that it was nothing experimental about it. Experimental means that you don't know how it's going to come out. And I just always found that fascinating because, you know, I like to experiment, but, you know, you also edit. So I think in trying things out, you know, it is a bit like a research in the sciences. You try something, especially with live performance, you have to test it out. You have to see it in performance on stage, for example. And then, you know, what works you keep, and what doesn't work you throw out, and you try something else. And that's the experimental side, I think, for me, of working with live performance on stage. There's something about the scale, as you asked a little earlier, you know, finding the right complement.
Mm-hmm.
in the physical space, the visual space, the rhythms. There's so many interesting things, color, contrast, rhythms that have to change in pacing over the period of the piece, mm-hmm. so that the right tone is achieved. And arriving at the right tone for something is really the challenge and consistency mm-hmm. factor.
Well, what got you interested in dance?
I don't know.
Just the whole, the movement and the...
I'm not a dancer myself mm-hmm. in any formal way, and never have been, but it's beautiful.
Oh, it can be,
absolutely. I also think dance that's very challenging and powerful and not necessarily beautiful also has its own kind of beauty. Yeah. In other words, there's a lot of postmodern dance which might have to make you think and twist your mind around it a bit, mm-hmm. but that to me is very interesting. Uh-huh. I guess even if it has words, of course, most dance does not, and it just applies on a completely different level of expression, mm-hmm. gestural.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it can be used for politics, mm-hmm. which I find very interesting as well. Yeah, yeah. Now, I've always thought when experimental film becomes mainstream, it starts being called groundbreaking, you know, if it works. So I find experimental and
well, I guess when I started getting interested in filmmaking myself, it was the late 60s and into the early 70s, and of course, there was intensive politics going on at the same time. Mm-hmm. But experimental film of that time, the American experimental film, and I was also interested in European film from, say, the 20s and 30s, mm-hmm. that was highly innovative then. And the American experimental filmmakers from Maya Deren on were very much at the forefront. I mean, just as we would go to see films by Antonioni and Fellini and Bergman.
I was into Bergman, yep, yep.
You know, that was my coming of age in film, mm-hmm. we were also seeing Brakhage and other filmmakers who completely were apart from narrative film. That the experience of watching a film that might be more abstract had its own kind of experience for the viewer mm-hmm. without telling a story. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's always been that appeal for me, that there's an expressive, just as in looking at abstract paintings, mm-hmm. that gives you something that's very hard to put into words or explain. We can speculate about them or why it's just beautiful or why it's just striking or stunning. And there are many, many experimental so-called filmmakers. So I think it would just be easier to call them more abstract.
That's a good point, really. That makes more sense to me. Now, before we do run out of time, I want to talk to you about your photography.
Okay.
What is your subject matter for photography, and how did you first get into it?
Well, when I left the museum world to go to Haiti.
It happened, the museum world was like this Pandora's smoke coming up.
Well, I loved studying art history, and so that's what brought me into doing graduate work in art history and getting involved in museum work. But I actually was quite disillusioned by the art world. The commercial art world, the art market. The more I knew about it, the less, maybe just less idealistic I became about the value and power of making art. Mm. And that's why the experience in Haiti was so powerful. Mm. When I left, that really said, no, this can be life-changing.
And it was really about art, probably, instead of business and money, the way art has become
but,
in this country.
So it was in that same period that when I left the States to have a different life, I wanted to see how it would be to just live as an artist, basically. So I was actually doing a lot of photography when I was mm-hmm. That would kind of opened up a tremendous amount of photographic work. I would go to, one project I had was to go to the market, various markets, but the iron market in the center of Port-au-Prince, I can only imagine what it looks like today.
Oh, gosh.
I would go, and it was also a way of forcing myself to learn Creole on my own, not from a book or other people in particular, but force myself to start to speak Creole and learn another language. I knew French, and then I found that was really a problem. You know, you don't speak Proust on the street.
Yeah, exactly.
I got into this structured thing for myself that every Friday I would go to the iron market and offer to photograph people. Mm. And the following Friday I would bring those pictures back. I
were you doing
them.
Black and white, the traditional
yes,
black and white?
I was printing in a dark room in the kitchen, you know, at night and that kind of thing. And then I would go back and I used a Hasselblad, a 2.25 medium format camera.
Oh, wonderful camera.
And beautiful also because people can see what you're doing. And most people were happy to have a photograph. I had a few occasions when people refused, and that's fine, you know. They'll have a lot of stories and anecdotes about that, but I don't know.
So you start? Did you start as a portrait photographer? Was
so
that what your main interest?
I did a tremendous amount of portraiture, but also landscape. Definitely, lots of landscape. I had exhibitions of my portrait work in Haiti and afterwards.
And we were talking about this before we came on the air, and I wanted to ask you about the olden days of photography and the modern day of photography. Tell us what you think about that. Do you feel like that there was a little bit more creativity expected when you had to develop your own?
There's something very different about the time factor. You take a picture in an analog universe, and you've thought about it, you take the picture, and you're going to have to wait and see how well it comes out and when you develop it. So there's a time lag, and as any photographer who's been through this knows very well, there's a really interesting time in the darkroom. Very meditative, it's very fussy. You might print an image many times before you're satisfied with it. There's a smell of the chemicals, which I don't really miss anymore. and there's that, you know, wondering what it's doing to your health kind of thing. But I did that for years, and I did love that process. But I have to say, I love doing digital photography, too. It's just different. You have the immediate feedback. You might shoot a lot. I used to shoot a lot anyway in 35 millimeter, but in medium format, you know, you're a little more careful. When you shoot 16 millimeter film or 35 millimeter movie film, you know, you have to have more discipline in shooting. It's expensive.
Yeah. So digital cameras have freed us up, perhaps to learn more about, you know, shadows and light and composition, because we can immediately see where we've gone wrong.
Well, it's also easy to be trashy and shoot tons of stuff that because it's cheap and easy and fast, you can lose the discipline while you're doing it. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if you pay a lot of attention, you can put it to your advantage. And I see it in teaching with my students when they're doing digital video editing, it's the same thing from doing film. There's less discipline maybe in the shooting, but eventually they can shoot more. And then in editing, they can get much farther. They progress farther. I've seen that because it's not so awkward and cumbersome in editing and re-editing. It takes so much to edit in film and then to re-edit it. So even those students who shoot film these days are still editing digitally, and they really progress very quickly.
And let's talk a little bit about your teaching. What's one of the main things that you teach people who are starting out in film?
How to stay open and creative. I've had this strange position of being the only filmmaking teacher at Cornell for 30 years.
The only?
Yeah.
To this day?
To this day, although we have a guest animator who was a former student of mine who teaches in the summer. It's a strange situation because there's so much demand for it. And people do make videos these days in other departments as part of their work in fine arts or in architecture and so on. But as far as the filmmaking program, I am the only one. We have a lot of film studies.
That's amazing.
Since I'm the only one, I actually feel obligated as well as behind it that people should figure out what it is they need to make as opposed to having a house style. Or you can only do narrative film, or you can only do abstract film, or you can only do documentary. So my first opening with my intro class every semester or year is really feel free to try out whatever it is that interests you.
So be experimental, perhaps?
Yes, although fewer students do that. There is such a huge urge to make narrative films, whether they are Hollywood-style conventional narrative or more indie, independent kinds of quirky narratives or, you know, there's sort of a New York school and a L.A. school of thought.
I think that's interesting, too, that it would be hard to describe, but we know when we're seeing an indie and when we're seeing a real traditional Hollywood type of film. And it's hard to put into words why we know the difference.
Well, that's a long story. We can go there.
Are you teaching people also to think about visuals and not just narrative and story as someone who comes from the art world? Do you emphasize that more than some filmmaking teachers might?
I don't know. There are plenty of filmmaking teachers who only teach abstract and experimental films, so I certainly don't do it more than they do. But in any kind of filmmaking, I mean, that's the thing. If you learn basic skills of framing and composition, about contrast, about color, you can apply them to any kind of filmmaking.
And then you can tell the story.
I have to say that coming from that experience in Haiti, in the Saint-Soleil art village, really that set up my sense of good pedagogy in the arts because I kind of learned how empowering that kind of freedom is.
Oh, yeah, indeed, indeed. We only have about a minute left, Marilyn. I want to ask you about your current project. You're working with the Cornell Prison Project, doing videos?
I am doing videos for them. I'm actually working on one of my own projects as well, which I'd also be interested in telling you about. But those two things are related because a very good friend of mine, Carolyn Geltzer, who's an actress who was a resident professional actress at Cornell for 3 years and is now in New York, was teaching at Auburn Prison. A theater class, and she taught it for 3 summers and asked me in the second summer if I would be willing to videotape the inmates who were her students' final performance. They were actually going to have a somewhat public performance. And so I did, and it was quite fascinating. And then this past summer, she taught the acting class again and had most of the very same students. And so I also filmed those scenes, and as well, I did other interviews for the Prison Project in their basic attempt to encourage more people to volunteer to teach.
Is this going to come out in a documentary form, or is it just an archive piece?
The Prison Project has developed a website, and they will be posting short videos so that people can see the range of things and hear from people who've taught there what the experience and satisfactions are of teaching.
Do you have the website in your head right now?
I would Google Cornell Prison Project.
Okay. That's great. That's great. Really quickly, what else are you working on?
Well, with this friend, Carolyn, I'm actually working on what I would call a mixed genre piece about the idea of a woman who's 50-something, early 50s, actress, very good, trying to pick up and go to New York and make a career out of acting, who has no connections but has a 20-some-year career and is a fantastic actress. So we shot about 7 scenes when she was still here, and really it's a kind of wait and see what really does happen with her career. She's been there a year and a half,
we'll see if that comes out soon. Well, Marilyn Rifkin, we have run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to whatever comes out of you next.
Thank you very much. It's been great.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.